study the scriptures on the doctrine of God's law. And in our confession, that's on page 670, which tries to summarize, 680, sorry, trying to summarize the Bible's teaching about the law of God. And we are slowly working our way through this chapter. We're on paragraph 4. We've already dealt with paragraphs 1 to 3. But before we read it, I want to ask a question and see what you all think of this. What would you say are some mistakes that Christians make about the Old Testament? Mistakes, different kinds of mistakes. Because when we talk about the law of God, we really are talking about the Christian's relationship, not just to the commands of God, but to the commands of God through the whole Bible and his law. And so it's about the Christian's relationship to the Old Testament. What do you think are some mistakes that Christians make? Yes, ma'am, Ms. Christine.
That it's no longer necessary in this day and time.
Yeah, that the Old Testament is called old, right? We have the New Testament, and so the Old Testament is passé. No reason to look at it anymore. What's the problem with that, first of all? Can you think of what the problem with thinking the Old Testament's gone is? Is just irrelevant to the believer? I mean, right away. If you say, I believe the New Testament, which I do, right? And you do. If you start reading the New Testament, what do you run into almost immediately? The Old Testament. Because the New Testament constantly quotes the Old Testament and uses the Old Testament. And in fact, the writers of the New Testament seem to be relying on the authority of the Old Testament for many of their teachings. You know? So it's inconsistent with the way the Bible itself deals with the Old Testament to say it's just gone. Excellent. What else? Ms. Sandra.
That the God of the Old Testament is not the same as the God of the New, that he's a God of wrath, and he's just
different. That's an excellent point. And really, if you say that this whole book was revealed by God, one God, but that the Old Testament has an ethic in it that has changed, or that the Old Testament has any revelation about God in it that has changed. And by the way, what is the law of God? It's a revelation of God, isn't it? I mean, why does it tell us not to murder, not to lie, not to that's God's own character, right? That's who he is. And so the law reveals God's character, as does the whole Old Testament, and showing how God relates to creatures. And so if you say something basic or fundamental has changed between the testaments, it implies that God himself has changed, or that there are two gods, right? Which Marcion, an ancient heretic, actually taught, that the Old Testament was revealed by a dark, evil God. This was one of the He wasn't a church father, but he was a teacher who's profoundly influential that the church fathers had to deal with and argue against. But that Jesus is the one true God. And so you have these, you know, Old Testament is one God, and then Christ is the true God. So the Old Testament, God is a God of wrath, but in the New Testament, we have a God of grace, which can't be if there's one God and if one God revealed the Bible. Right? Great point. Other thoughts? Anything? Seth.
They separate Christ from the Old Testament.
Yeah. And that's actually the same point, isn't it? But it needs to be made distinctly, because if Jesus is God, then Jesus revealed the whole Bible. Right? And the whole Bible is revealing the character of Jesus. And so if we say the Old Testament is gone and we don't need to read it or look at it or study it or obey any parts of it, then it implies a separation of Jesus with Jesus, right? Or that Jesus didn't reveal the whole word. Excellent point. Very good. Any others? Just want to see? Does anybody else have a thought? Brother Paul.
The Old Testament mentality that the wrath of God for sin can be satisfied by a physical act of sacrifice or so many Hail Marys or whatever, that mentality has gone forward. And so that is a mistake that people make in looking at that, the Old Covenant versus the New Covenant under Jesus' blood.
That's a very important point. So a lot of Christians and those in the high church tradition, you know what I say when I mean that? I'm talking about those who believe in baptismal efficacy and in the efficacy of the sacraments in general and coming to church and that there's some mystical power in the outward elements to save you. The problem with that is even in the Old Testament, those things couldn't save you, right? So it's consistent all the way through. In the Old Testament, the Jews misunderstood and thought that the sacrifices could save them and that their good works could save them. That's what Romans 9 tells us. They pursued righteousness as though it was by law instead of by faith, you know? And so it was the Jews misunderstood the Old Testament. The large part of them did. Not all of them did, but many of them did. And Christians misunderstand the Bible in the same way today. That's an excellent point. Any other thoughts? Good. Well, we've been looking at specifically the Ten Commandments. And a question I have here is, how does a Christian know what Old Testament laws to obey? I mean, they all reveal Christ to us. They all reveal God's character to us. But how does the Christian know when you're reading the Old Testament? This is, by the way, very practical, isn't it? Because if you read the Bible and you're studying the Old Testament and you're running across all these regulations and laws, what do you do with those? How do you know what's for you and what's not for you? Hermeneutically, it means in terms of how the Bible explains itself, where do we look to see which laws of the Old Testament to obey? Yes? That was a passionate outburst. I'm for that. That's good. Yes?
I don't really know the answer, but it seems to me that I've heard that what carries over to the New Testament that we learn in the New Testament confirms the Old. We certainly don't stone our sons and daughters today. And I think that God was the ruler at that time. He was their leader. And when Jesus came, we transferred, just like we transferred out the sacrifices, we no longer do that. But Jesus was our sacrifice, and so we depend more on the Old Testament for those kinds of, the New Testament for those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the way we know what laws to obey is the New Testament teaches us that. Right? So what you're talking about is things that the New Testament tells us about. It all reveals the one true God, right? So even when you're looking at the stoning of children at the city gates, that tells you something about how much God hates rebellion, doesn't it? And about how jealous God was to preserve his nation, because what if a nation grew up like ours is with just rebellious children everywhere? It's going to dissolve eventually. A nation can't survive with lawlessness. And so God was very serious about preserving the line of Christ. So we learn things, but we don't practice the stoning of children. And we'll talk more about this today. It's actually our topic. But because the New Testament teaches us this, you see? So which laws do we obey fundamentally in the Old Testament? Are we required to obey? Brad?
Teaches.
So Brad says the Old Testament laws were a foreshadowing of what the New Testament teaches us. That's true. But if you read the New Testament, what you find, and we're going to see it today, I hope, and we saw it in Romans already, is that there is a natural law that's not really rooted in the Old Testament at all. It's rooted in you as a human being. But the Bible teaches it, and the New Testament teaches it very clearly. That all men made in the image of God know by nature not to murder. That's universal. Everyone knows that's wrong. They know by nature not to lie. They know by nature not to steal. And the big question's always the Sabbath. But I would submit, don't you know by nature that it's wrong to work your employee and never give him a break? That's enslavement? Don't you know that that's wrong by nature? I think you do. You know by nature to worship the God, and you know there's a God in your heart because you're made in his image, to worship the one true God of heaven and earth. You know by nature not to covet. All these things you know, not to commit adultery, to take another man's wife or a woman's husband. You know this. And so this is rooted in your nature, and the New Testament clearly teaches it. So does the Old. But it's rooted in creation. And so that's the basic moral law of the Ten Commandments. This moral law is summarized in the Ten Commandments that transcends, that means cuts through, the whole Bible. Every covenant has the moral law in it because it's the heart of God's own character of love and goodness. It's not a list of rules to keep because God just wants to see you jump through some hoops. It's how he's designed the world to reflect himself, and he's designed you to reflect himself and to know his love and to love him. You see? And so that's what the moral law is summarized in the Ten Commandments, and that's perpetual. And so we're going to see some of the laws in the Old Testament, they're all mixed with civil, ceremonial, and moral laws. So how do you know what to obey there? We're going to look at that. But let me just ask this last question before we look at the confession. Is there a practical benefit to knowing that the Ten Commandments summarize the moral law? If you know that that's the essence of what's required of you, which is what Romans 2 says, which is what Romans 13, we're going to see this in the Bible. But if you know that, how does that practically help you? Seth?
We do have a lot of Christ's life recorded in the Gospels, but we don't have every single possible situation that Jesus faced in life recorded
for
us.
That's a good point.
But we have the Ten Commandments, and we're told that that's what Jesus did. In every single situation, mm-hmm. he applied the Ten Commandments. And so as a result of that, we do know how to walk just as he walked mm-hmm. in every single situation in life.
And here's another question. Are you supposed to do everything Jesus did? Everything? Now, Jesus fulfilled the whole law. And when he was keeping the law, you obey him. But as God, did he not have the right to do certain things you don't? I mean, he had incredible authority. You have that kind of authority? You know? We're not just to mimic simply the life of Christ. We're to walk as he walked in obedience to the law. So the law helps us know which aspects of Christ's life to actually emulate. Do you understand that? He also did some very hard things that we're supposed to do, but probably only he could get away with doing, you know, like righteously angrily whipping people in a temple. Not people, sorry. Whipping in the temple and turning over tables and such. Now, that's keeping the moral law, and it's a perfect keeping of it. It'd be very hard for us to do it, although that is a model of us for how to keep the moral law. So that's a practical benefit. Have you thought of this, too, that if you don't have some, like, points in your mind of what summarizes how to live as a Christian, it can become very mushy and hazy as a whole, you know? So what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to, you know, be like Jesus. And so what's consistent with Jesus? The little bracelet, what would Jesus do, you know? Well, that's not a bad question if you have the whole rest of the counsel of God helping you to answer that question, including his law. But think about the Ten Commandments. They're not comprehensive, right? Because don't commit adultery. What's the other side of don't commit adultery? Husbands, love your wives. Wives, love your husbands. It's lead, protect, provide for your wife, husbands. It's pursue her, husbands. It's be faithful in your marriage, right? That's the other side. So don't commit adultery is just a negative side. But what is it really about? It's about family and sexual ethics. It's the family law. Don't commit adultery. You see? What is honor your father and mother? That's one point of a broader picture. What is honor your father and mother? Respect the authorities that God has put in your life. So the bigger picture is, included with that, would be submit to the government, Romans 13, 1 Peter 2, right? And, you know, I have to obey my leaders in the church, Fred and Mitch, and submit to them, right? And so there's church-level authorities. And so the fifth commandment is about order and structure in this world and authorities in this world. What's don't murder about? The bigger picture of don't murder is it's about how we function in society. When we don't have what we want, do we kill to get it? It's about war in its broadest sense. It's about how we relate to others that we disagree with. It's about conflict. And that happens all the time. That's don't murder. So you see how the law of God, what it's doing, here's what I want to say, why I mentioned all that. The Ten Commandments are touching down at key points of your whole life, giving you a sense of what God requires in them all, in every aspect. And if you don't have all of those in your mind, you're very likely going to miss something. You know, you're going to, and you'll probably miss it along cultural lines. You know, whatever your culture is denying about what's good and right according to God's law is what you'll tend to accidentally deny and even think you're righteous as a Christian. That's happening, you know, among Christians today. I could give examples, but I won't get into it. But there are Christians getting off track today. Because they don't have a sense of what God requires of the believer. Yes?
I hope this is not too big a question, but can you comment on moral law as revealed by God versus what people call natural law? You hear that sometimes
yes.
In law theory and judges right. And things like that.
Well, so he asks the question, what's the difference between moral law and natural law? Now, there's a legal theory called natural law, but then there's also a theological theory called natural law, and they're different. So the legal theory is this, that I can, through just looking at the way things work in nature, I can make a case from what is out there to the way it ought to be in law. You see? So it's from is to ought. The problem with that is you can't actually reason from an is to an ought. I mean, because you think of this, it is natural that your hair grows. Does that mean you ought not cut it? Are you following? Lots of things are natural that don't imply a moral imperative to them. So that kind of natural law reasoning that you find in legal circles, I think is not valid. But in theology, natural law just means this, that you are created by nature in the image of God, and by nature, as an image bearer, you know what's moral. Now, you can tear all that up by sinning. You can destroy your conscience. You can suppress what's true, and you do if, you know, you're to the degree that sin remains in you. But in theology, natural law is right and good, and the Bible teaches it. That is, you know what's right or wrong because God has imprinted it on your very nature. Now, so in theology, natural law and moral law are the same. They're the same thing. And so moral law just means this. It's the law that reflects God's own morality. That's what moral law means, his own character. So, like the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that he put in the garden, that's not moral. He could have made some other symbol than a tree. He didn't have to put a tree there. He could have put whatever he wanted, you know, and said, could have, I think I've said in here, you could draw a circle and say Adam and Eve can go everywhere in the garden, but don't go in that circle. You know? Could have. So there's nothing inherently moral about God commanding a tree, or some of those real detailed regulations about exactly what to do with the entrails of the animals, you know? I mean, that's not moral. That's positive. But moral law has to do with inviolable moral principles rooted in God's own character that can never change and can't be other than what they are. There's no universe in which God makes image bearers in which they're free to murder each other. You see? There's no universe in which God makes image bearers and it's just fine to lie. That's impossible. God can't create a world in which those things are good or right. You see? So, does that answer your question, brother? Yeah. So we were talking about practical benefits, and I'll just mention one more that I think of. If you know what the moral law of God is, summarized in the Ten Commandments, it's bigger than the specific commands of the Ten Commandments, but you know that the Ten Commandments are getting at a summary of the whole moral law of God, then you know what? You're free. You have liberty to love God, keep his commandments, and then do as you please. Right? You're not bound by the doctrines and commandments of men. No men, including this man who's your pastor, including the government. It tells you to do something other than what God says. You obey God rather than men, you see? So you're free from having your conscience bound by men. You're also free from your own senses and impulses that could be mistrained. You know, I feel like this would be the better, the right thing to do. Well, no, what does God say in his word? And so this, the doctrine of Christian liberty is rooted in a clear understanding of law, that you are free and you have liberty to live your life according to the calling that you have and what you enjoy, if you're keeping the moral law of God, right? Questions? Okay, so let's read paragraph 4. Was there a question? Oh, we got a question. Brad has a question. Hold on, they got to hear you in the other room, so that's why we make him run around with that mic.
An application of one aspect of what you touched on as far as the moral law, what we know, I like looking at nature. I had a situation come up at work. The guy is discussing a TV show he started to watch, and it's dealing with the universe and answering tough questions, you know. And he says, he makes a statement, and I didn't say nothing in reference to it. It was in a crowd of coworkers, so I didn't. But after the fact, I was wondering if I should have said something, and the statement he made is this. Nobody really knows. I mean, if you're a Christian, you believe this, and if you're not, you know. But the fact that what we're discussing this morning, what everyone knows, non-Christian, non-converted, unregenerated, and the regenerated, there is something there. Now we can deny it, we can choose to look the other way, but there's something there. How would you address that kind of a situation?
Something there in a Christian? Is that what you mean?
In the people in the world, saved and unsaved, there is something there that we all know and understand, but we either deny it or we turn a blind eye to it.
So in both Christians and non-Christians, there is something there. That's what we are talking about, actually.
Yes.
Is it
that's,
what's
that's
there?
That's what I'm getting at. In application, how would you answer that situation? What would you do?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what kind of answer you're looking for, but I would say this, that I know that no matter who I talk to, I have a friend inside that person that really knows what's right and wrong, and that actually knows God, even if they hate him. And so when I speak to them and I talk to them, you know, about truth or the gospel, I know that they have a conscience that agrees with what I'm saying. They do. They may deny it, they may totally argue against it, and it may not seem like they're agreeing with what I'm saying, but I can assure you, when I tell them, you know it's wrong for you to live in rebellion against God, it's wrong for you to lie, it's wrong for you to murder, I know that their conscience is crying out and they're doing everything they can to shut it down. And so, practically, it frees us from being afraid to talk very openly about these things. There's not an equal playing field, you know, in the sense that, you know, we're just all reasoning together to try to figure out what's true, and if we all just did our reasoning correctly, we would arrive at truth. No, there's something natural in all men that knows the one true God.
I don't know if this helps, but for me, it kind of thinks of like what you were talking about, I forget how many Sundays ago it was, but you were talking about people who, you know, say that Christians just use circular reasoning when they always go back to Scripture. Everybody has some supreme authority. Everybody uses something whenever they argue. And for what he's saying, what it sounds like is, you know, especially at universities, people will say, you know, well, what's right for you is right for you, and what's right for me is right for me. And that's just not true.
And people don't know that. They don't actually believe it either.
Right. Yeah. They don't believe it. They don't know it. And so what they reduce is they'll say nobody knows. And a lot of times what they're saying is there's so much out there that we don't know. How do we really know what we know? And what the Bible tells us is that that statement is true in humanity. But in order to know anything, you have to know everything. And God does know everything.
Amen.
And he has given us direct revelation. And part of that is the natural revelation he has put in us as his image bearer. So even though they suppress the truth, they deny it, it's true.
And they can't ultimately deny it. They spend their lives trying to. Good point. Excellent point. Okay, well, why don't we try to do at least one paragraph today? This was a great discussion. I hope you benefited from it. I really enjoyed it. So paragraph 4. First, let's just review. Let's just read paragraphs 1 through 4 to see what the confession says. But we'll give attention to paragraph 4 in here just a second. It says, paragraph 1 says, God gave to Adam a law of universal obedience written in his heart, and a particular precept. So notice two things, right? Law of universal obedience. And then the second thing was an outward particular precept that God had to speak to him of not eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, by which he bound him. That word bound just means obligated. Bound him and all his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience, promised life upon the fulfilling and threatened death upon the breach of it, and endued him with power and ability to keep it. Paragraph 2. The same law that was first written in the heart of man continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness after the fall, and was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments and written in 2 tablets, the first 4 containing our duty towards God, and the other 6, our duty to man. Paragraph 3. Besides this law, commonly called moral, God was pleased to give to the people of Israel ceremonial laws. Now, do you notice a parallel to what we read in paragraph 1? Paragraph 1, God gave Adam a law of universal obedience written in his heart. It's the 10 commandments. And a particular precept. And then here, down here in paragraph 3, besides this moral law, God was also pleased to give the people of Israel ceremonial laws. And the key distinction, I've said it several times, but it bears repeating, is inside and outside. So moral laws inside of you. Ceremonial laws are outside. That is, they have to be commanded. So Adam would never have known not to eat of that tree unless God said, don't eat of that tree. It wasn't in his heart not to eat of that tree. God had to tell him. The same is true of the people of Israel. They all knew not to lie, not to murder, not to steal, and so on. By nature, they knew that. But the people of Israel did not know that they had to obey the ceremonial laws until God commanded them exactly what to do with the bull, and with the goat, and with the priesthood. God had to tell them that on the outside. And so that's paragraph 3. Besides this law, commonly called moral, God was pleased to give the people of Israel ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances. That means ordinances that are pictures So commands that are really pictures of something greater. Partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, and partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws, being appointed only to the time of Reformation, are by Jesus Christ, the true Messiah and only lawgiver, who is furnished with the power from the Father for that end abrogated and taken away. So the ceremonial laws are abolished in Christ. And it says that they had two purposes. One was to prefigure Christ. The other was to teach you something moral. So you remember in the Old Testament at Passover, what the unleavened bread, right? Well, Paul uses that in the New Testament and applies it to purity in church life. You see? And so the ceremonial law of unleavened bread was actually a picture of something in moral law. Are you following? Because Paul uses that in 1 Corinthians 5 to say, you know, a little leaven leavens a whole lump, and, you know, purge the leaven from among you. So there's a moral aspect to ceremonial laws that's underneath them. Now, paragraph 4 says something very similar about judicial laws. It says, to them also he gave sundry judicial laws. That means various. He gave various judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution, their general equity being only of moral use. So, Mosaic judicial laws. Since you're reading in our hymnal, you won't see this, but in many of the copies today, there's a typo there. So if you have one at home, it might even be in the little green one that we give out. It's got a mistake in it. It says, their general equity being only for modern use, but the word here is not modern. It is moral. It is moral use. That's a huge difference, right? So just note that. But this part of the Mosaic law had to do with the theocracy of Israel. Their laws that God gave Israel to govern their state. So you think of what these would be. Laws about the king and how he's to rule. Laws about things that mark the people out as distinct, you know. So even laws about what fabrics not to weave together. That's a civil law. Why? Because it was marking the people as different, this particular people as different. Specific case laws. So all the case laws, like stoning the children at the city gates who rebel, that's a civil law. So all the applications, don't boil a goat in its mother's milk, you know, all those things are civil laws, and they passed away with the coming of Christ. It says that they expired. So expired here means died, that they're gone. And how do we know? Because really what's really happening here is that the whole old covenant is fulfilled and abolished in Christ. We're not under the old covenant. And those commands that were given from the outside, the civil laws and the ceremonial laws, were covenantal. And so with the fulfillment of the Mosaic covenant and its abolishment, according to Hebrews 8, it's passed away. That's what it says. We have a new covenant. The old is passed away. All the civil laws are also abolished because the covenant itself is abolished. You following this? So like a good example is circumcision. This gets into the whole paedobaptism thing, that if really the civil laws of the old covenant are abolished, because the old covenant is abolished, how can you argue that because infants were circumcised in the Old Testament, infants should be baptized in the New Testament? You can't. You have to look at the new covenant to tell you what to do with new covenant commands, right? With the new covenant positive laws. Okay, so these laws that belong to the Mosaic institution expired. Second, it says their general equity may be of moral use. Now look at 1 Corinthians 9 to get an idea of what they mean here. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 8. I think that's a wrong place. Let me find it here. Yeah, where is that? Oh, it is? Oh, it is. Oh, so it is here. So read verse 8 with me. It says, Paul says, "Do I say these things on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain." So the idea here is if an ox is, you know, grinding grain, and I'm not sure how they did it, but there was an ox tied to an arm that was tied to a centerpiece, and the ox would push the grain around and it would grind the grain underneath. And there would be grain that the ox would be walking on as he was grinding the grain or treading out the grain. And I could be wrong. He might have just treaded it. I have no idea how this worked, so I'd need to look this up. But either way, he was doing this work to tread out the grain. And if you muzzled him, he couldn't eat from his own labor. And the Old Testament says, don't do that. That's wrong to that animal. You know, you need to let the animal eat from his grain as a civil law. That was an old covenant civil law. But there's something moral underneath it, according to Paul. And here's kind of the argument. If it's true that an ox should be treated equitably, how much more should it be true for a person made in God's image? So let's keep reading. Verse 9 again. For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not speak entirely for our sake? It was written for our sake. Because the plowman should plow in hope and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing the crop. If we, that's Paul and the apostles, if we have sown spiritual things among you, is it too much that we reap material things from you? If others share in this rightful claim on you, do we not even more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know, and here's what he's getting to, that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. And so that's why you pay me, frankly, and Fred. It's this very principle that you don't muzzle the ox while he's threshing, that the laborer is worthy of his hire. That's what Jesus says in Luke. And so there are moral, what, by the way, what moral law is that? Don't steal, right? So if someone works, you pay them for their work, right? You don't steal from them. So here's the important point. Though the civil laws and the ceremonial laws of the Old Testament are abolished in themselves, that doesn't mean they have nothing moral to teach you. Let me give you another example. You know, there's an Old Testament civil law that says build a parapet around your roof. Do you know what that is? David Sevier said they still have parapets in the fire industry there, or as a fireman. They dealt with parapets. But in the Old Testament, what a parapet was, it was like a fence on your roof. What was the point of that, you know? Well, it was because in the Old Testament, they would walk along the top. Their houses would be all stacked together, and they'd have flat roofs. And it was a way to get somewhere. You get up on the rooftops, and you traveled on the tops of everybody's roofs. And if you came across a house that didn't have a fence or a railing, no parapet on it, you could fall off and die. You know, someone could be walking quickly and bump you over the side. And so what moral principle is there underneath the civil one? Don't murder. You see that? Don't murder. So in the New Testament, how do we apply it? Do you remember the big snow, the great blizzard of last year that we had? And I had the Christmas party at my house, and we were, there was black ice and everything. And so based on this principle, it was right for me to, and I got one of someone from the church to help me figure out how to do that. I didn't know where to get it, but to get rocks, to get salt. And we salted our sidewalks. Why? Because if someone had slipped on ice, they could slip and fall and break their neck. You see? So salt your sidewalks. That's what build a parapet on your roof means now, right? There's a practical implication of do not murder in the real world today. And so the fact that all the civil laws are abolished in themselves doesn't mean they have nothing moral to teach us. They do have something moral to teach us that we can take and apply to ourselves. Okay, any questions? Yes, brother, we got a couple.
So what about the, you know, something that's very popular is the culinary aspect, the food laws that they had. What about that? Where do we, you know, certainly we eat crawfish, we eat the unclean animals, the pork and so forth, but how does that carry over practically, or does it?
Well, you know, theologically, there's a couple things. Number one, the food laws, the whole purpose of things like why you don't weave certain fabrics together and why you only eat certain kinds of food, what is food? Think about what food is. It's great in Louisiana to think about what food is. What is food in Louisiana? I mean, it's culture, isn't it? I mean, there is distinctively Louisiana food, you know? There's distinctively Southern food. And so when I go, you know, I lived in Germany when I was a kid. There's distinctively German food. And so the reason that God gave them food laws was to encapsulate that people, along with a lot of other laws and customs and practices and feasts and festivals, all these things, was to encapsulate that people in a culture that was very different from and even repulsive to the nations around them. Why? So they wouldn't intermarry. It was so that other nations would look at them and say, you're really weird. And you got some weird practices, and I don't like the kind of food you eat. Really? You know? Because what was the point of the unclean foods? It was to say, you are a clean people, right? That you are a holy, sanctified people that for the preserving of the line of Christ. So that's the reason for the cultural encapsulation by food laws and all the other civil laws and practices. It was to preserve them. And it's not just to keep them from intermarrying, it's also to bind them to each other. They have something deeply in common with one another, and it's like glue. Culture is like glue. And so there was a very strong, heavy Old Testament culture that was really weird to the world, but it bound them together and it kept the other people out. It helped to do that. So that's one thing. The other thing is, so in the New Testament, in Acts, Peter saw a sheet come down and he said, everything's clean. Now he said two things are clean, people and foods, and they're connected. Why? Because food is a cultural thing. Why were Gentiles so repulsive to the Jews? Yes, they were sinners, but we see even in the book of Galatians, because they didn't eat right. You see that? And so if you're like, you don't eat right, your culture is weird, you eat foods that are repulsive to me, and vice versa, how do you have one church where they're joined together in one gospel? So the food laws came down because the boundaries between the nations come down in Jesus. The new covenant is every tribe and tongue. You see? The old covenant was a people of the Jews only for the sake of the preservation of the line of Jesus. You see? And with the passing of the old covenant as a whole, all ceremonial and civil laws, including food laws, go away. They're not commanded. We are free in Christ to eat crawfish. Why? But theologically why? It's theologically why, because you can really be a Louisianan. You can, and be a Christian, and be faithful to God without disobeying him. You see that? You can keep your culture. And what binds us together in Christ is love, the gospel itself above all, and then the love that we have for one another, even if we have different cultures. You see? Did that answer? Yes, sir. One more.
We may want to hold this for next time, but paragraph one, the particular precept, is there an essence to the command of avoiding the tree of the knowledge of good and evil?
An essence to it?
Yeah, I mean, what was the point? Was it just arbitrary, or was it to keep Adam from something? To keep him from trying to become God, from keep him from pride, or was it,
well,
you know, something?
Here's the thing. Under any positive law, some positive laws you could conceive of really just didn't have to be there the way they were. I mean, they could have been something totally other. Other positive laws make sense in the context in which they were given. You know, so you have a garden, which makes sense that there would be a tree. There would be a tree of life and a tree of death. But look, anytime God gives a positive law, any of them, the Lord's Supper, baptism, any of the ones that we have in the New Covenant or the Old, if you break that positive law, you are rebelling against the whole moral law. The first commandment's what? You shall have no other gods before me. And so if God says to be baptized and you say, well, that's just a ritual that I don't need to do because it doesn't mean anything, it doesn't have power to save me, by disobeying it, you are breaking the first commandment and the second commandment and the third commandment and the fourth commandment. The same is true of the Lord's Supper. You know, a lot of Christians think in terms of, I don't need the Lord's Supper. You know, why do I need to come to the Lord's Supper? I mean, I can do my devotions at home, and it's just a ritual, and it's not important. But look, whether you understand why or how it's important or not, God commands it. And if you don't obey his command, then you're committing a moral transgression because you're breaking the first commandment, and the second commandment, and the third commandment, and so on. You see? So all positive laws in the covenant in which they're given have a moral implication, all of them. Right? Did that answer your question? No? So I think God gave the trees to give Adam an opportunity to be tempted to break the whole law, either to follow God or not. That was the question. And that's why he put the tree there. And had Adam passed the test, he would have had the opportunity to break the law, but would have actually fulfilled it and would have been righteous. But because Adam didn't, he broke it. Jesus had the same thing in the wilderness of temptation, where, you know, he was fasting and he had an opportunity to break his fast and follow the devil, but he didn't. He succeeded where Adam failed and where Israel failed in its wilderness temptation as well. Yes.
Are you asking if there was anything in the fruit itself that was inherently,
like mechanically, like if I eat of this, there's a poison in there?
To provide a test for Adam, you know, there was a test where that he had power to either pass or not, to either obey or not. But the particular result, the temptation was, I think, to be lifted up with pride, wasn't it? To Satan told him,
become like God.
You'll become like God if mm-hmm. you do this. I mean, and it made sense to Adam. Yes, if I can get the knowledge of good and yeah. evil, I'll become like God.
Which is a moral transgression.
Which is a moral transgression. I mean, so.
But it didn't have to be a tree. I'll state that again. I'll, mm-hmm. I'll say that whatever symbol God chose was wise and good and fitting. And the tree it was, because it's a garden. You know, it makes total sense that that was fit. But I don't think there's something inherently moral about whether it was a tree or something else.
No, but good knowledge of good and evil versus life.
That
you know,
there part
was not
is
a prohibition. Yeah,
that part is moral.
Okay.
Yes. Uh huh. I said one more, but I guess.
Would you say maybe this will? Would you say this is the reason why it was that way? Was because there would be no other distinguishing factor.
Say
other
that
than,
again. The reason it was that way.
The reason it was the tree in a garden, fruit that was probably at least in some ways indistinguishable from any other tree or fruit other than God's positive command, was so there would be no other distinction other than, are you going to love me?
I think so. I think it was a test of their total character and whether they're going to grow up into full images of God or not. Yeah, that's a great point. But there's a reason that it would have been that way. Very good. All right, well, we have to end, and so let's close with prayer.